So, what questions? Questions?
We're 921. We're starting to kind of follow the book.
So that's the one that is a magnet, and I deleted the turns on?
Right.
Yes.
Does that mean we can still find the field, or do we just get like a ratio of B and H?
So you're going to find a ratio of B and H. And you're going to then plot it on the on this graph, kind of like those lines.
Like, okay, this is about it.
Well, I would use a straight edge.
Straight edge?
Yeah.
Oh, and then the line that pierces it.
Yeah, so you just find that intersection point.
Okay.
It's doable. Say again? 21, the last problem, slightly modified, so that it is exactly like the section that I cite. So it really is just following the rules for that section.
So do we, how do we use this?
So that's a different problem, and I'm not sure I have a copy of that handy, but so it says that it's soft iron, if I remember, and one of those curves, I think it's like F or something, is for iron?
Yeah.
Yeah, the letters are kind of hard to read, but with a little bit of work.
So, pure iron sheet. Yeah, yeah.
So that's going to give you an appropriate mu.
Okay.
And it's obviously going to be pretty crude, because that's a log-log plot. So, but do your best. More questions? Taxes. Okay. So with dielectrics, your knee-jerk reaction should be to kind of replace the epsilon by the epsilon naught. That's how a lot of problems work. But I do want to remind you not to go too far, right? So the Gauss's law that we learned first was this one. It has an epsilon naught. And the Gauss's law we learned second doesn't have any epsilon naught, so it has a D field. But this is not a version of Gauss's law. So you maybe can derive it on some occasions from this guy, but don't do that, right? So these are the starting points for dielectric sort of problems. And pretty similarly, mu goes to mu naught in pretty much the usual way. That should be your knee-jerk reaction. And the same thing applies to Ampere's law, as I said, for Gauss's law. So we had one Ampere's law that the integral of B dot dl was mu naught I, where I was the total current, and we had another version of Ampere's law that the line integral of h dot dl was the free current. Use one of those two as your starting point. Again, kind of by analogy, for dielectrics, we were still able to use Gauss's law because even though there are bound charges, there isn't any bound charge density. And that was a consequence of the fact that there was a linear proportionality between the free charge and the bound charge. And typically, inside a dielectric, there wasn't any free charge. So there would be bound charges on the surface, but not inside. So we could still use Gauss's law. And very similar stuff applies to currents, right? So what I'll call the bound currents, the atomic currents, are linearly proportional to the free currents. And so if there aren't any free currents, then the bound current is going to be zero, and we can use the usual sorts of relationships. So then we talked about magnetic circuits, and I don't know, way down here is the footnote. none of this stuff is particularly exact. B fields love to be inside magnetic material the way current likes to be inside copper, but not quite so much. And things are nonlinear, so mu doesn't have a particular value. Which L are you talking about, an inside circumference or an outside circumference? There's a fair amount of uncertainty, and you really shouldn't expect these equations to be accurate to, you know, kind of plus or minus 10%. But the starting point was Ampere's law. Then we swapped B's for H's, and then we swapped B for flux because we figured that flux was going to be constant. So magnetic field would stay inside the conductor. And then since flux was a constant, it pretty much played a role like I. We had reluctance, which was this formula, which is very similar to the formula we had for resistance. And it is a useful idea to think about this as kind of like a version of an electrical circuit, where the Ni is kind of like the forcing term, the voltage. The flux is the constant term, kind of like current. And the reluctance is very similar to resistance. In general, the reluctance is going to be the sum of lots of different pieces, but often it's dominated by just the gap, the air gap, because mu is going to be 1,000 times smaller than it is in other sorts of material. In that circumstance, the B field is what you would get for an infinite solenoid that had the same number of turns per length. And you kind of think about this yoke as being a flux return, that whatever flux comes out of this piece of it goes back in. And so from the point of view of this gap, it looks like it's part of an infinite solenoid with the flux just going on and on and on. So sometimes the yoke is called a flux return because it makes things look like an infinite solenoid. We talked about the case of permanent magnets. That's the case that we just talked about. So on the backwards part of the hysteresis plot, there's a relationship between the demagnetizing H field and the magnetizing B field. So this is a material property. We derive this linear relationship between the B inside the permanent magnet and the H inside the permanent magnet. That was this linear relationship. And we have to simultaneously satisfy both. So we have to be at that point. The purpose of keepers for permanent magnets is to reduce the reluctance, which is to increase the slope of this line, which means we have less demagnetizing H field. Questions about that sort of stuff. So then we went on and hit induction. So induction is kind of the new guy on the block. We're going to be spending a few chapters on him. So Faraday's law says that if we take the time derivative of the magnetic flux, we get how the E field is pushing things around in a circle, which we call an EMF. And if we rearrange this a little bit, we get that the curl of E is no longer zero if there are time-varying electric fields. So no longer can we say that the electric field is minus the gradient of the voltage. There's this other term that needs to be cropped on too. So the electric field now can go in circles due to changing magnetic fields. Questions? Yes? Funny you should ask that. Quiz! So, if you take a piece of copper and you move it through this uniform magnetic field that is out of the board, which one of these is going to be the case? A, B, C, or D? I think I like B. I have to think about it. So what's really here are electrons, but it never hurts to think about positively charged particles being the conductors. So I'm going to think about there being movable positive charges. If they're moving this way, then there's going to be a V cross B force. So V cross V, V cross B is going to be down. So the positive charge is going to accumulate here and the negative charge there. And with that charge separation, there'll be a voltage.
Yeah.
So these are called motional EMFs. And
emotional
EMFs. Motional. Starts with an M. I'm not so hot on them, is I guess what I would say. We'll maybe talk about it a little bit later. Usually you can solve these sorts of problems by thinking about flux. This is an example where you can't, because there isn't a loop, but
it's kind of like a meaningless.
Well, so the way I think about generators is because they have changing flux, but you can think about generators as being caused by moving that piece of copper around in a magnetic field. And it works just as well. There are various kind of tricky aspects of it that I prefer to talk about it in terms of flux. And if I wanted to talk about this, incidentally, what I would talk about it in terms of, well, relativity. If you got on a train that was moving at the same speed as this piece of copper, what would you see in terms of electric and magnetic fields? And it turns out that if you change frames of reference, the magnetic fields and the electric fields are not invariant. So you get a different combination of electric and magnetic fields if you're in a frame of reference that's moving relative to their sources. And we may or may not get a chance to talk about that. Other questions? Well, since we've started with quizzes, so a south pole is approaching the solenoid. Which way is the current going to flow in this wire, up or down? I couldn't tell you off the top of my head. This is right-hand rule, angel food cake.
This is the point when you usually say, I show this to my 106 class and they know.
Which is exactly true. Exactly true. If you go look at the exam, you will see a problem very similar to this one, except it's a north pole approaching the same solenoid. And they almost all got it.
Oh, thanks. Why?
No.
What are we crossing? B cross with?
Well, because no, the magnetic field should be pointing up. I mean, like, if it was in a place inside of it,
that's not one of those.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So
it's
going to go off.
So yeah, it's
going to go off.
So the question is the induced current in this wire going to be going up or down?
Wait.
The straight part of the wire. This piece here. Is everyone committed? So what did you commit to? You're not committing. You're going to go with down. I haven't thought about it, so I can't tell you what it is. So.
The 106 got it. I don't
know. We only had 5 minutes with it.
You had all last time with it. That's true.
Yeah, we remember that.
Okay, so you know that the B field leaves the N part and it comes in the S part, right?
Yes.
So the magnetic field here is up and it's getting bigger with time. And Lenz's law says that the induced current is going to fight that change. So it is going to want to make a magnetic field that is in the opposite direction. It's going to want to make a magnetic field that is this way.
Why
it's a fact. It's a definition of what a North Pole is.
Good.
North Poles are like positive charge. You believe me on everything else. Okay, so this wire wants to make a magnetic field that's down. Which way does the current want to flow in order to make a magnetic field was down? So if I put my thumb in the direction, I'm thinking about this top turn. If I put my thumb in the direction of that top turn, then my fingers are going down, which is what I want. So I claim like that. So the current shown is increasing. Which way is the current going to flow in the secondary circuit? And the answers are, yeah, left and right. To the left, to the right.
Starting from the front, yes.
Yes, starting from the visible surface of it. So the 105ers are supposed to put little arrows on their wires. The majority is saying... Okay, so the current is increasing through this solenoid. Which way is the current going to flow in this secondary, this single loop that's sitting outside of everything? Okay, so which way is the magnetic field that this current is making currently? Right, so if I put my thumb in the direction of this bottom loop, my fingers inside are going down. So this is making a magnetic field that's down, and it's getting bigger down with time.
How do you know that?
Because the current is increasing.
Okay.
Problem says that. So the secondary current wants to fight that change. It's conservative. It wants to make something that has a magnetic field that's up. So which way would it need to have its current flowing to make a magnetic field that's up? And I think the answer is this way. If I put my thumb in the direction, it goes like that. Is that what you all voted for? Okay, so we've got a long straight wire, square loop. For several minutes there's been no current flowing, but now we're going to get a big current flowing to the right. Which way is the current going to go in the square loop? Okay, so there's an increasingly large current that's going this way in that wire. Which way is the current going to go in the square loop? So the current is increasing in this long straight wire, and we're asking which way is the current going to be induced in this square loop? So what way is the magnetic field in the center of this loop currently? It's into the board, and it's getting bigger.
Why is it in?
Because the current is increasing.
But when I go like this, isn't my finger pointing at me?
So when I put my thumb in the direction of that current...
You're below the wire, so you have to be like this.
Oh.
Yep, so of course on the other side of the wire, the magnetic field is coming out of the page, right? Because it's circulating around. So so this little loop wants to make something that is... coming out of the board, right? It wants to make one that's going this away. Because it's conservative. It wants to fight the change. It always, always wants to fight the change. And so it's going to be going like that to do it. How about this little circular loop out here?
Is that
Yeah, so this is the one where the 106ers get upset at me because no current, no induced current, right? Because there's no flux. There is a magnetic field, but it's going around in a circle, so that B dot dA is zero. So if that B gets bigger, it still doesn't change the fact that the flux is zero. So no change in flux, no induced current. So we should we do more of those just for pure enjoyment's sake? Not today. Okay. We've done enough for today. Now we get to do some mathematics that the 106ers wouldn't be happy with. Say again? That was their third test. And I think it's your homework. Okay, so let's start with the general case and then kind of talk about specifics. So imagine that we've got lots of different circuits, right? So here's a circuit, let me call that circuit 2. Lots is going to be 2 in this circumstance. Here's another circuit, let me call that circuit 1. But in general, there are going to be lots of circuits. So we use the right-hand rule to define the normal to these circuits. So that's going to be the normal to that circuit. And I think I'm thinking that this is on the outside, so the normal is going to be this way on that circuit. So the magnetic field at any particular spot is going to be the sum of the magnetic fields due to all of those individual currents that are flowing. And of course, those things are proportional to the currents that are flowing in their respective wires. And the flux for any sort of piece, that's just the integral of the B dot dA. So that also has to be proportional to the current that's flowing in any of these wires. So kind of generically, we can say then that the flux through the ith circuit is equal to the sum of some constant coefficients that depend on the geometry and the currents that are flowing through those circuits. So these things are called inductances, and well, there's kind of a special case where the current we're talking about is making a magnetic field through the circuit that we're talking about. That is to say, where J is equal to I. So if for M, I, we're going to call those L sub I, and those are called self-inductances. Anything else is a mutual inductance. Okay, so let's get a formula for the mutual inductances. So the B field we can calculate at some particular spot, R2, and I'm using a 2 because I'm thinking about this being in the vicinity of the circuit that is 2. That's equal to the Biot-Savart law, mu naught, the current. We'll just talk about current through circuit 1. 4 pi, and then we're supposed to integrate up dr1 and then r2 minus r1 divided by the magnitude of that vector cubed. And also, this is the same thing as the curl, according to coordinates 2, of the A field. And we can calculate the A field. There are lots of different values of the A field, but one way we can calculate the A field, the one that we've talked about the most, is by the current . Okay, so far so good. So if we want to calculate the flux through 2, what we want to do is to integrate over the surface that is 2, the magnetic field at location 2 dot dA2. Okay, so if we follow this all through, this B is proportional to the current that's going through all of this. So the mutual inductance, I'll write it as a division, but it's basically the flux going through two versus divided by the current that's going through two. That's equal to all of that stuff now without the I. And then we have the magnetic field at location 2 dotted into the area 2. This is an M for mutual inductance. Okay, so we can write the B if we want in terms of A. It's going to be the curl according to coordinates 2 of the integral of dr1 divided by the magnitude of r2 minus r1.
And I just
want
clarification, is that the B that's on the line above, B down to the right, yeah, is that of r2?
Yes. Okay. We're integrating the flux over this circuit. Okay, well, we'll stick with the same pen even though it's pretty fat. So now we've got the curl of something, and we can convert the curl of surface integrals into line integrals. So this is mu naught over 4 pi, do a line integral around 2 of dr1 divided by the magnitude of r2 minus r1. So this is the line integral around 1, and we also had this line integral. Now I should have done them in the same order. This is the line integral around 2, and this is the line integral around 1. And the main point of all of this is to see that this is symmetric, right? I could switch around the 1s and the 2s, and I would get exactly the same value. So the mutual inductance, how circuit 1 affects 2, has to be exactly the same thing as how the mutual inductance 2 affects 1. Conceivably, you could use this to calculate the self-inductance, but that's going to be a little bit hairy because, of course, at some point along the circuit, you're going to have the same value of R and you're going to get a 0 in the denominator. So with care, you can do that, but often it's not a good way of proceeding to find your self-inductances. Okay, so that's kind of the mathematics of it. What's the maybe more practical calculations of that? How is that going to work out? So let's take a look at a kind of pretty simple example. Here I've got a donut, and I've got some turns . Say I've got N1 turns here with some current that is going to be I1. And I also have some turns . Maybe I want a better . Do I have a better red pen? Yes. So here I've got N2 turns that have some current I2. What exactly is the flux that we're going to have? Well, if we think about making a Gaussian surface, or excuse me, an Amperian circuit, what we get is that the integral, and I am going around this way, so that the normal to that integral is out, and all of these wires are then bringing current up through that loop. So the integral of H dot dl is going to be the total enclosed current, which is going to be N1 turns, each one carrying current I1, and N2 turns carrying current I2. Now, if this were a perfect donut, then the H field would have to be cylindrically symmetric, and we could pull it outside of that integral, and this thing would be exactly the same thing as H times 2 pi r, depending upon whatever radius I was talking about. So the H field will be stronger when I'm near the center of this donut when r is small than when I'm at the outer circumference when h is big. And we could carry that all through, but just for the sake of a simple example, let's just talk about r being the average r, and I won't say more about it. And in fact, why don't I just call this whole quantity L and treat it as if it were a constant? It's not true. H is going to be stronger here than it is there, but it's just going to cloud how this is all going to work. Okay, so at the same time, we know that the H field is equal to B divided by mu. So what we've got then in the end is that the B field inside this solenoid is mu divided by L, and then all of these turns and currents. Because there's an L here.
Right, why is there a mu times L?
Oh, thanks. Why is there a mu in the bottom? Oh, okay, no, everything's fine. So let me rewrite this, maybe it'll be a little bit clearer. So what I've got here is B times L divided by mu.
Right, right, oh yeah, okay.
Okay, so the flux through one loop, that's going to be, at least approximately, the B field times the area, right? We really should be doing this integral, and we really should be dealing with the fact that this B is not constant through this cross-sectional area, but all it's going to be is an extra complication. So close enough, 200. Say again?
Flux through one loop.
Yeah, flux through one loop. So the flux through all of these loops is going to be, so this is now for circuit one, is going to be the number of loops that we have times this thing here. And we have this formula for the magnetic field. It's not mu naught, mu divided by L, and then we have N1 squared I1 plus N1 N2 times I2. And we can now read off that the self-inductance, that's the term that's proportional to the same current that we're talking about, the self-inductance is going to be mu over L N1 squared. And M12, that is to say how I2 affects the flux through circuit one. Thank you. I dropped my area. So M12 is going to be mu A divided by L, and then the product of those two values. And I hope it's perfectly clear. We could do exactly the same thing for phi 2. And what we're going to get is that L2 is equal to A mu divided by L N2 squared. And M21 is going to equal, well, the same thing, right? Because whether I write it as N1, N2, or N2, N1, it's still exactly the same thing. So you might notice in this case that, that M21 is equal to the square root of L1 times L2. And basically, that's an upper bound. For a more general circuit, the mutual inductance would have some multiple of this, which has to be between 0 and 1 as a limit. And if you want to get technical on me, it could be minus 1, too, if we just define our currents to be the other way around. So mutual inductance has limits of plus or minus the square root of the self-inductances. not particularly useful, but maybe useful factoid. So if we look at the voltages that we would get from changing currents, right? So the current, the voltage that we would get from 2, that's minus the change in the flux in 2. So that's going to be minus L2 di2 dt minus. Yeah, so this is a symbol that people commonly use for EMFs, which mean basically the same thing as voltages. So that's an, yeah, so that's a an E. Oh, you're saying what is that? That's a script E.
Oh, okay.
Like calligraphy E. And similarly, E1 is going to be minus L1, di1 dt minus M12, same thing though, di2 dt. And let's look at what seems like a very special and particular case. Let's look at the case where the current is zero in the secondary circuit. And therefore, the changes in the current are going to be zero in the secondary current. So if we look at E2 over E1 under those circumstances, so E2 is only going to have this term, and E1 is only going to have that term. And you can see that the time rate of change in the first current is going to cancel out, and the minus signs are going to cancel out. Each one of these mu's had a mu, each one of these m's had a mu times the area divided by L. Those will cancel out. So if we do all of that cancellation, what we're going to get is n1, n2 divided by n1 squared, which is just n2 over n1. Okay, so if it's not obvious at this point, this is the transformer equation that you learned in 200 or 106, whichever one you took. I know that. But I took it. So what this says is that if we want to have E2 a lot bigger than E1, if we want to have more voltage coming in than what we had going out, it may sound like it's not possible, but it is. All we have to do is have more turns in the secondary than we do in the primary. And contrary-wise. So if we want to have a transformer that steps down from 120 volts to something that your cell phone might like 5 volts, all we have to do is make a transformer that has the proper turns ratio. So this may have seemed like a unlikely and unusual sort of qualification to make all of these equations true. And the upshot really is that transformers are way more complicated than this 200-level equation. If you're dealing with a real transformer, things become pretty complicated pretty fast. And it depends on how much current you have flowing in the secondary, what voltage you actually get out of it. And of course, not only is that a problem, but typically transformers have iron in them, and therefore they're going to have nonlinear behavior. They're way more complicated than the 200 level view of them. But surprisingly, if you're doing electronics, you can go a long way in electronics not bothering to know all of those complications. So the people who design transformers design them so that people who don't know any more than this formula can make them do what you want to do. But if you try and use them in a non-standard way, you'll quickly discover that they're way more complicated than that simple equation. Maybe that's another time to talk about kind of a detailed technological aspect of transformers, and in particular this kind of simple circuit that I've that I've described. And I tried to convince you that the current was only going to flow through these wires. But if this was really iron, it's a pretty good conductor too. We're going to get currents that are flowing inside this iron. And if there's current flowing and it has resistance, then there's going to be loss. There's going to be heating in this transformer. So we very much want to somehow or other keep the current from flowing through the iron and just flowing in the copper. So how do you do that? Well, if you look carefully at a transformer, what you'll see is that it's not made of a solid hunk of steel. It's made out of a series of plates, and those plates are separated by a little insulating layer. So as a result, we have a lot of iron, but we can't get any current to flow any great distance because it's all separated out into individual plates. Say again? Because we want the high mu. And if you think about ferromagnetic materials that have high mu, they also generally have big conductivities, with one exception, right, that we talked about before, the ferrites. So if they're not doing this, they're using ferrites. And that's, if you look at that little core that's at the, that connects your charger to your cell phone, that doesn't have this sort of plating. They're just making it out of material that has a moderately good mu and a pretty small conductivity in order to make it all work. So undesirable currents like this that would try to flow have a name. They're named for eddy. And I should maybe ask you, of the standard 200 demonstrations, which ones do you remember strongly? Because if not, I should show them to you sometime. Yeah, so that's the eddy current demonstration. You have this gutter that is made out of aluminum, and if you roll something that's non-magnetic down, of course it falls basically at G. But if you try and have a magnet that's going through that gutter, it falls at a constant velocity that is way less than what you would expect. And that's because what's happening is you are driving eddy currents in that aluminum, and it's providing an energy loss mechanism. So the energy you gain from falling, instead of accelerating the particle, is going into heating that piece of aluminum. You all remember that demo? That's an easy one to bring up. So the other one that's a must-see is the floating ring. Did you do that one? So do you guys remember seeing that? That's one of the all-time best demonstrations.
We have 25 minutes. I know what you're checking your phone.
Well, I'm wondering whether we can go down there or not, and whether it would work if we went down there, because it's a pretty old piece of equipment. Sometimes it requires some work. So there is a metal piece, and if you look in detail at what this metal is made out of, it's not made out of a solid hunk. It's made out of individual rods, which have insulator between them. So we're not going to be getting big eddy currents through that. And then there's a coil that's wrapped around that rod that is being driven by, you know, your favorite plug, right? 120 volts and 60 cycles. So there's a constantly changing magnetic field that's going through the solenoid. And what happens is that there's a single ring that is going to be supported by this changing magnetic field. What happens, of course, is we get an induced current in this, and then we have a V cross B force that's able to support that thing. You know, I'm tempted to go down. So Let me comment about what comes next. So if you remember what we did after dielectrics, we did electrostatic energy. And one of the reasons we did energy was to remember the plus or minus sign when we had things that were connected to voltage sources or whether they were disconnected from voltage sources. And the important result about the energy density being 1/2 B dot D. So we're going to look for equivalent things for magnetism. And I hope it's kind of no surprise it's going to end up being B dot H as having the corresponding energy. And there'll be different signs according to whether the thing has constant flux, like it would for a superconductor, or being connected to a power source like a battery. I know what I want to do. Yes. So that's what's coming next. And after that, what we're going to do is, remember I promised you that we'd redo Kirchhoff's laws when we had something interesting to do? Well, we now have capacitors and inductors and resistors, so we can do all of that sort of stuff and really do impedance right, where we have complex numbers for our resistances as opposed to just real numbers. But I wanted to come back to this idea of emotional EMF that we started with. So if you remember this drawing, we can understand how we get charge separation and hence voltages when we have a conductor that's moving through a magnetic field. And at least in my impression, it's almost always easier to think about this in terms of fluxes as opposed to these sort of forces. But that's something that needs to be proved. Can we show that the change in flux is exactly the same thing that we would calculate if we were calculating the motional EMF? So what we need to deal with then is the case where we have a circuit that is moving, right? So here's the circuit initially, here's the circuit after some time, delta t. It's moved on. It's moved on some distance that we could calculate, of course, by taking the velocity times the little bit of time. Now it might be smart here to kind of break up the two things that are going to be going on. If we're thinking about an electron that's moving in this wire, it's going to have a drift velocity. So I might as well denote the drift velocity by u. And there's going to be some motion of the whole circuit with some velocity v. And of course, the whole velocity vector of the electron is the vector sum of those two. And that's what needs to go into the equation for the force. Q equals, I'll write it as v, but it's the full velocity. So it's w cross b. Okay, so we need to get this w out. It's not just v that is the velocity of those electrons. So the V is the actual motion of the wire. So V is the wire moving, and U is the electron moving in the wire. And you remember, these drift velocities are not particularly fast, but it's nice to do things right. Okay, so remember, if we actually need to calculate flux, we need to have normals and we need to have directed normals, so we need to have orientations for these circuits. So with the orientation I've drawn, the normal for these circuits is going to be going, generally speaking, up. And we want to calculate the change in the flux as the circuit moves from this situation to that situation. So this is situation 0 and 1. And we can calculate the new flux in kind of a funny way. And that is, if you remember what we said before, if we have a circuit, it doesn't matter what we use for the surface. The same flux is going to go through any old surface. So we can choose our surface in a particularly nice way so that the change in the flux becomes evident. and that the way I plan to calculate the flux for the new circuit is by using the old circuit and then this ribbon that's going to connect the old and the new. Right? So the flux under the new situation is the flux under the old situation plus the flux that's in that ribbon. Which is, of course, another way of saying that the ribbon is the change in the flux. Okay, so we do have to get our sign conventions right. If we want to hit, so we are basically comparing the flux through that first loop to the flux that's using part of the second loop and then this ribbon that's around the outside. And we have to be consistent about our normals. So the normal for the original surface was up, so I want to choose a normal for this ribbon that is kind of like this, kind of pointing in and up. And if you think about it, I can do that by taking the cross product of the velocity vector and dl. Right? So in fact, exactly what I want for my normal is...
DL.
So dl is a segment of the original circuit. So we're going to have, to get that inward going normal, we want the velocity vector crossed into dl. And again, multiplying that by dt, this is going to give me the area vector. When you do a cross product, you get the area of the parallelogram that it encloses. So this change in flux, I'm going to call it deflux now, we're going to add up the little bit of area, which we've said is v cross dl times dt, dotted into the magnetic field at the appropriate location. Okay, so now the kind of important factor. This was the velocity of the circuit. If I replace that by the velocity of the electrons, is that fair? It certainly is not the case that the velocity of the circuit equals the velocity of the electrons. Right? The difference is this velocity along the path of the circuit. But u cross dl is zero, right? Because they're both in the same direction. So yeah, so yes, I can replace this v by w at no cost because this term, in fact, doesn't contribute anything. So what I've got then is the integral of the magnetic field dot w cross dl, and there's a dt that is eventually going to make its way underneath the d phi to give us the time rate of change in the flux. So now remember, you can switch around dots and cross. So this is the same thing as the integral of b cross w dot dl. And for the cost of a minus sign, I can switch those guys around. So what I've got is minus w cross b, that's the force, dotted with dl. So what we've shown is that minus the change in flux with respect to time is the integral of the force per charge, I'll denote that as force per charge, times dl. And that's exactly what we mean by EMF, the extra force that's pushing things around. Okay, so we can either go with those motional EMFs, or at least my favorite way of working is to always think about this in terms of fluxes. Okay, so if I move this guy away, that's a motional EMF if you want. If I move that guy away, which way is the current going to flow? Right, so now I have a slightly different situation. I'm imagining that the current is flowing steadily in this wire, and I'm moving, I guess I should start with a new, not confusing piece. So we've got a current that's flowing through this wire, and my plan is to move this circuit away.
Move it up.
which way is the induced current going to flow? I don't know. So we have a steady current that's flowing this way, and I'm going to move this square loop down. Which way is the current going to flow? People committed? They're just being quiet about it. So the magnetic field is going to be down at this location. As I move that thing away, that magnetic field is going to get less and less and less. And I can just use the Lenz's law. Don't have to worry about motional EMFs if I don't want to. So the Lenz's law says the magnetic field is going to try and fight the change. So this is getting smaller. So the magnetic, so the wire is going to want to make a magnetic field that is also down to augment the declining magnetic field that it feels in its interior. For it to make a magnetic field that's down, it wants to have a current that's flowing that way.
So it's going to want to also have a
Yeah, so Lenz's law is a conservative idea, and it's trying to maintain the what's inside the, its coil. The magnetic field down is getting smaller, so it decides to make a magnetic field that's into the page, thank you, not down, to try and maintain that. It'll fail unless it's a superconducting coil, but it'll try, and it can do that by having a wire that's going around, a current that's going around clockwise. You can if you want. So you should be able to get the same answer by looking at motional EMFs. And of course, there's no motional EMF for these wires. Is that true? So we have a B that's into the board and a velocity. So that's just trying to push it sideways. So that's not going to do anything. So the only motional EMFs are going to come from those two wires. And we have to get the same answer, but as I say, I'm not a fan of thinking about things that way. I am a fan. Seems to me like flux is, you have to learn about Lenz's law anyway, so why not apply it as much as you can? Okay, so again, for the sake of the 105ers, if I move this circuit this way, which way is the current going to be induced? No way, right? Because there's no change in flux. We want to try and run down and see if the levitation will work. Since I'm old, I'll move faster than you guys, I guess. The demo room between 167 and 171.
No, it's not very rainy yet.
So there are lots of things that can go wrong, so don't get too hopeful. Yeah, it's an old. The new versions of this, in my opinion, aren't as, and we have new versions of it, but they don't work as well as this thing at least used to. So one of the things that has happened is this coil falls through now. I don't know if that's going to be enough or not. Well, what do I think? If it's so, I was able to get it to work for my 106ers. Well, that's copper. That's a bad choice. Well, I'm not.
Just like
me. I'm not super confident. Oh, good. Pretty neat.
So what is that in the middle?
It's just steel. It's just zillions of little steel rods. And all it's doing is having a big mu so that you can magnify the magnetic field that you get. And the other thing that's kind of interesting is, I guess that's not blood. It gets warm, right? Because it's got there has to be multi amps that are flowing through this thing in order to make it work.
It's just like the noise.
Mm. 60 cycle hum. So the other one was the falling one. Oops, wrong spot. Electricity. Here's electricity. Resistors, magnets, batteries, compass, superconductors, circuits. Ah. Right, so there's nothing, this is a non-magnet. This is just to show you that there's no tricks.
There are always tricks.
Whoa. Remember that.
Rare.
Pretty impressive. So this damping ability of magnetic fields is not uncommonly used in physical meters and things that you want to quickly reach the right spot. So there was I don't know if any of you guys did the torsional oscillator for Jim. Torsional pendulum. That's got a damping, eddy current damper on it in order to change the damping. Again, we can challenge you to see if you're up to 105ers. I don't know if this will work, but it's at least a good potential. Now, if I were to hold this, it would probably burn. I don't know if anyone wants to check that, but it gets nice and toasty. So, I need a battery. Can you see that wire is moving towards me? Is that a north pole or a south pole? Well, so this is the pointy end of a battery.
Down.
Well, I wouldn't say down so much as towards me. It's also going down, but it's towards me.
Well, I mean the field is down. But
so if the field were down, it would be a south pole.
No, from the wire, I mean. Yeah. I don't know.
I'd do like QV cross V, so the current's going this way, right?
Yep, current's going this way.
So Q or V is going this way, crossed with upward, downwards B.
So B has to be going down, yeah. So it has to be a south pole. Yeah. What's the...
Sure. Say it one more time.
So current's this way, mm-hmm. And the magnetic field, let's test, just guess and test. Let's guess that it's down.
The magnetic field?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is the cross product of those two? Which way is it pointing?
Okay. Wait,
oh, Q. So current is that way, and the magnetic field is that way. If I cross those two vectors, which way does it point?
At you.
Yes. And that's what we saw, right? We saw the wire move towards me. Mm-hmm. So the magnetic field must be going down, so that has to be a south pole. Mm-hmm. What is the Earth's north pole? A south pole or a north pole? It's a south pole. So why is it a south pole?
Because the north pole magnets point towards it.
Because the north pole magnets point to it. So north poles are really north-seeking poles. So which way is the current flowing inside the Earth to make the north pole be a south pole?
Clockwise, from the top of it.
So that's B. Inside the Earth, B has to be going like that, right? No, sorry. Backwards. Oh, those were right, but okay. I was, a lot of that was right, but not all of it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so it wants to be going like that, right?
Cool.
What is it?
He brands himself.
So will this one be levitated? So that's how you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to now make a wire that connects these two together. And I've never actually done that as a demo because it has to be a really good conductor because zillions of amps are flowing through this. More than you could easily measure. Well, you can see that this battery is probably putting an amp through that little wire. It would be a rough approximation. And it's doing this kind of wimpy motion back and forth. So we need 100 amps or something in order to levitate that other thing.
No, actually, you came one by one. I talked to you for like a minute or two.
Really?
Yeah. You told me your computer broke.
Well, I need to decide what I'm going to talk about first, I guess.